program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today, A Technology for a Low-Trust Society. This was written by Charlie Warzel. A few hours before Donald Trump gave his State of the Union address, Republican sources told the PBS correspondent Lisa Desjardins that the speech would break records. The president would speak for more than 2 hours, she reported on X. And one reliable source claimed he might ramble on for 180 minutes. The post went viral. At about the same time, the market started to move on Kalshi, an online platform where people can invest money in the outcome of a given news event. Don't call it gambling. Forecasts on how long will Trump speak for the State of the Union shot up by 10 minutes after Desjardins posted. Armed with what they perceived as insider information, users thought they could make a buck by accurately predicting the outcome of his speech. But others speculated in a different direction. They're leaking a bunch of stuff about a super long speech, and he'll go about 2 minutes short of the supposed mark, and everyone in the White House will make $200,000 on it. One Blue Sky user at Dan Vogfan posted a few hours after Desjardins' post went viral. In other words, maybe the sources really did have good information, but they were throwing off others off track to manipulate the market and profit for themselves. Prediction markets such as Kalshi and Poly Market have ushered in a moment when anyone with access to exclusive information related to a major news event can do this. Even the platforms themselves prohibit market manipulation. Trump ultimately didn't speak for as long as the sources had said. He ended after 1 hour and 47 minutes. Anyone who had bet according to the information that Desjardins had reported would have lost money. We live in such a profound dystopia, another popular Blue Sky user wrote above at Dan Vogfan's post after the fact. We can't definitely say that any insider trading was actually happening, though other suspicious incidents have occurred. In early January, one Polymarket user bet more than $30,000 on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro being ousted just hours before he was captured by the U.S. military. The bet paid out $400,000 and led Representative Richie Torres to introduce a bill that would ban federal workers from using prediction markets. Last month, Israeli authorities charged two people on suspicion of using classified information to bet on military operations on Poly Market. And this past weekend, an anonymous trader who goes by the name Magamian made more than $550,000 on Poly Market by betting on the timing of U.S. and Israeli strikes in Iran and the fate of its supreme leader. Welcome to the democratization of insider trading, brought to us by platforms that let people wager on election outcomes, sports, and, quote, Taylor Swift pregnant before marriage, quote, end quote. The prediction markets frame bets as tradable shares that rise and fall like stocks, financializing every current event and piece of online ephemera and generating a pervasive hum of paranoia. The world as a hedge fund, where everything can be derivative. Greed is good. Prediction markets claim to harness the wisdom of crowds and provide reliable public data. Because people are putting real money behind their opinions, they are expressing what they actually believe is most likely to happen, which, according to the reasoning of these platforms, means that events will unfold accordingly. Many news organizations and Substack now have partnerships with prediction markets. the subtext being that they provide some kind of news gathering function. Some users who distrust mainstream media turn to the markets in place of traditional journalism. But in reality, prediction markets produce the opposite of accurate, unbiased information. They encourage anyone with an informational edge to use their knowledge for personal financial gain. In this way, prediction markets are the perfect technology for a low-trust society, simultaneously exploiting and reifying an environment in which believing the motives behind any person or actions becomes harder. Polymarket did not respond to my request for comment. In response to concerns about trading on the outcome of the Iran strikes, the company said that it aims to, quote, create accurate, unbiased forecasts for the most important events to society, end quote. Jack Such, a spokesperson for Kalsi, told me, war markets put Americans at risk and have absolutely no place in prediction markets. Unlike Polymarket, which technically operates outside of the United States, Kalsi, is subject to U.S. government regulation. It does not allow bets on wars or assassinations, though it did host a vaguely worded market pertaining to whether Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei would be out. After he was killed in the conflict, Kalsi did not resolve the market to yes, enraging some users. We share concerns about war markets, death markets, and insider trading. We don't allow any of these on Kalsi, Such also said. Having a market on whether or not the U.S. will enter a civil war is insane. Not all prediction markets are the same. Polymarket has indeed hosted such markets. But these differences, though relevant in specific instances, do not have much bearing on the larger problems that these platforms contribute to. Prediction markets are selling a philosophy. Tarek Mansour, Kalsi's CEO, said that the company is replacing debate, subjectivity, and talk with markets, accuracy, and truth. And Polymarket CEO Shane Copeland said his company is the most accurate thing we have as mankind right now. On X, both Polymarket and Kalsi have their own accounts that act as news feeds, where they post engagement baiting and occasionally misleading headlines and speculate about world events that, conveniently, one can bet on via their platforms. On a recent Tuesday morning, Polymarket's X account looked an awful lot like a newswire, posting, breaking, Ken Paxton projected to win today's Texas Republican Senate primary, and putting his odds at 83%. Paxton ended up with about 40% of the vote, slightly less than his opponent John Cornyn, who was polling at 18% on Polymarket at the time of the post. The two will compete in a runoff election in May. The markets also encourage a kind of metagame. People are betting on outcomes, but they are also hedging with side bets. For example, this winter, the Polymarket entry titled, Will Jesus Christ Return Before 2027? Climbed from 1.8% betting yes to roughly 4% betting yes in 1 month. The bizarre spike made their rounds online before a perceptive X user noted that the real reason for the change was that Polymarket traders had created a secondary market to bet on whether the odds of Christ returning would climb above 5%. Those traders were then manipulating the original Will Jesus Christ Return Before 2027 market to try to make money on their secondary bets. This means that markets don't always reflect what people think will happen as much as they reflect what people think other people think will happen. This certainly gives the lie to the promise of accurate, truthful information from these platforms, as do the suspected incidents of insider trading. When a market is manipulated by people with exclusive information, it does not provide clear, actionable intelligence to everyone else. That's because many of these markets come and go quickly. Somebody who was up at 2 a.m. and happened to be paying attention to Polymarket's Iran airstrike market may have been able to pick up on Megamiman's big bet and gain a subtle informational edge. But it was absurd to compare this subtle signal to credible reporting or intelligence. Kaushi, at least, seemed to realize this. Such told me that the platform bans insider trading not only because it's unfair, but also because it erodes trust. Insider trading is also illegal, a point that a spokesperson for the White House repeatedly pointed out to me without addressing my questions about whether the administration has set its own rules forbidding government workers from participating in prediction markets. So they're specious forecasting tools. Yet the prediction markets are bad for another, much more obvious, corrosive reason. Beneath the veneer of forecasting, the platforms are funneling gamblers to markets to bet on human suffering and acts of war. The top market on Polymarket's homepage, as I write these sentences, was, quote, "Will the Iranian regime fall by June 30th, end quote. More than $6.7 million has been wagered on it so far. Betting on geopolitics and military operations allows traders to profit off of death, and it transforms people, politics, death, trauma, everything into commodities. In the wake of the first strikes on Iran, Polymarket briefly allowed trades on when a nuclear weapon was likely to be detonated. Current events, no matter how heinous, become entertainment, a business plan, or both. What Jason Kobler of 404 Media recently dubbed a depravity economy. As the depravity economy grows, it will break whatever trust we have left in one another. If prop bets spur athletes to play differently, this poses an existential threat to the integrity of live sports. If people believe that anonymous government insiders are profiting off classified information, what reason is there to trust anything that the administration says? There's a term called the liar's dividend, which describes an information environment where mis- and disinformation, such as deepfakes, become so prevalent that anyone accused of doing something awful can simply use them to cast doubt on genuine evidence. Prediction markets offer an insider's dividend, creating an environment where the prevalence of prediction markets and insider trading becomes great enough that everyone assumes a given decision was made to enrich those with an edge. This is the central lie of prediction markets. They claim to get us closer to the truth, but in the end, they make us less certain about the world. But this erosion of trust is a feature, not a bug, for these platforms. A world where people are suspicious of every motive is a world where the cold logic of gambling feels more rational. A zero-trust society is one where the prediction market's dubious wisdom of crowds marketing seems extra appealing. In this way, prediction markets are a system that justifies its own existence. A well-oiled machine chipping away at societal trust while offering a convenient solution to its own problem. The prediction markets have done what any savvy trader or firm might. They've hedged their bets. The house can't lose. Today's second story, A Presidential Problem of Canine Proportions, written by Nicholas Florco. Since the dawn of the Republic, one recurring scandal has plagued administration after administration, presidential dogs behaving badly. Little historical record exists on how the first pets in the White House behaved, but one of their names provides some hints. John Adams' family called their dog Satan. Future animals did not behave much better. Franklin D. Roosevelt's German Shepherd Major, allegedly bit the United Kingdom's prime minister and tore his pants. Theodore Roosevelt's bull terrier Pete chased a French ambassador up a tree. And Calvin Coolidge's fox terrier, Peter Pan, ripped the skirt off a woman who was eventually given away to Coolidge's secretary. More recently, Joe Biden's German Shepherd's major and commander come to mind as the quintessential presidential pets that run amok. Major, the first rescue dog to live at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, was sent away less than a year into Biden's term after a biting incident, only to return and promptly bite someone else. Commander was sent away in 2023 for similar behavior. It was later revealed that he had attempted to chomp down a Secret Service member's some 24 times, chomp down on them. As my colleague Elaine Godfrey wrote after Commander's banishments, dogs act like dogs, and sometimes like real jerks, even when they live in the White House. That may be the real issue with presidential pets. It is against his nature to be so repressed. Henry Child's Merwin wrote in an article about the dogs in the Atlantic in 1910. My six-year-old cattle dog Mix can get whipped into a frenzy over the sight of a man wearing a hat. I can only imagine how she would act if left to live in a sprawling new house full of strangers. Nevertheless, presidential dogs' propensity for misbehaving prompted me to wonder why our leaders even have them at all. Conventional wisdom dictates that parading around a pup is a political ploy meant to humanize politicians. Donald Trump objected to a pet for that very reason. During his 2019 campaign, he told an audience that walking a dog on the White House lawn might look good, but it feels a little phony to me. Dogs have certainly played important roles in several presidential campaigns. In 1928, Herbert Hoover's team printed and distributed thousands of photos of the candidate with his Belgian shepherd, King Tut. Franklin D. Roosevelt, amid a faltering campaign for a fourth term, successfully turned a scandal involving his dog, Fala, into a rousing monologue that was broadcast nationally and helped reinvigorate his standing. And perhaps most famously, then-Senator Richard Nixon defused a brewing scandal that he had maintained a secret campaign fund for his own personal gain by introducing Checkers, his family's new dog, on national TV in 1952. After defending himself against the corruption accusations, he concluded that his family did get something, a gift, after the election, a little Cocker Spaniel. As Lee Hubner wrote in The Atlantic on the 60th anniversary of the Checkers speech, that address salvaged Nixon's career, plucking a last-second success from the jaws of abject humiliation. As a dog lover myself, I find it hard to stomach that these animals are kept in stressful environments, sometimes to win political points. It is difficult not to care about a dog, even if that dog rips the pants of a prime minister. And perhaps that is the point. As Merwin put it in 1910, dogs soften the hearts of men. They teach their owners loyalty, compassion, and unconditional love, not in spite of their unpredictable nature, but because of it. Living in the White House is usually made easy by all of the staff who work to deliver on any presidential whim. Maybe a little mayhem is good for the people in power. Next, How America Learned to Love Barnes & Noble Again, by Henry Graybar. Barnes & Noble was once the avatar for sinister big-box stores on the march against independent businesses. In 1998's You've Got Mail, Tom Hanks plays an executive at Fox Books, a thinly disguised bookstore chain, who puts out of business and also weirdly seduces an independent bookseller played by Meg Ryan. Local bookstores were, at the time, folding en masse, and people were mad about the growing predominance of chain retail. Then Barnes & Noble got its comeuppance. In the years after the 2008 financial crisis, it closed more than 150 stores. To some extent, the bookstore was experiencing the same predicament of chain retail generally, which, after robust expansion that put mom-and-pop shops out of business, declined. Business declined faster than independent stores in the age of e-commerce. Amazon was doing to Barnes & Noble what Barnes & Noble had done to the local bookstores. But today, in a world more online than ever, Barnes & Noble is experiencing a revival. It opened 60 new stores last year and plans to do the same this year. It is reportedly soliciting banks to handle an IPO, a sign that a turnaround effort by Elliott Investment Management, the hedge fund that took the company private in 2019, has reached its conclusion. Distinctions between chain and local have been superseded by the split between online and in-person shopping. Book-buying Americans, whose support for indie shops was one of the hallmarks of a progressive anti-chain movement that flourished in the 2000s, seems to be less discerning than they used to be. They'll browse where they can. Consumer politics may have mattered less than good business decisions, however. Barnes & Noble found its form, in part, by learning from its eternal rival, the local bookstore. The corporate stores, with their forest green signs and scratchboard illustrations of famous authors, used to be cookie-cutter copies of one another. Now they come in all sizes, and the books inside vary from place to place according to the tastes of each store manager. What's more, they sit in a commercial landscape that, though thoroughly diffused with national brands, has been losing exactly the type of middle-class, something-for-everyone store that Barnes & Noble tries to be. James Daunt, who was brought in as CEO after Barnes & Noble was taken private in 2019, was evidently the right person to implement these lessons. He got his start in the industry by founding Dot Books, a skylit London shop whose screen-printed tote bags are a fixture of that city's sidewalks. It's as if Walgreens was being run by a pharmacist, or Kroger by the owner of a Russ and Daughters. Dot just helped turn around the UK's Waterstones chain, also owned by Elliott Investment Management, and now he got to know its beleaguered American cousin. He encountered what he described to me recently as a retailer's mindset, an obsession with standardization and consistency that, he said, had crushed the bookstore's business and its soul. A fixation on big floor plans, in Daunt's telling, was the reason Barnes & Noble shut down the last of the stores it had acquired from B. Dalton after the financial crisis. Daunt has gotten attention for a strategy that delegates authority to local store managers, letting them choose what books to stock and to promote. No longer does the New York headquarters cut a check from a Big Five publisher to place the season's hot new memoir on front tables nationwide. If you go to a Barnes & Noble in New England, you might find a section on shipwrecks right at the front of the store. A store in the Florida Panhandle will have a shelf after shelf of Bibles. A store in Washington, D.C., has a lot of books about Washington, D.C. In one respect, there's a Barnes & Noble playbook for national chains to follow, delegation and diversification. Indie bookstores have proven particularly resilient, growing their numbers in defiance of Amazon's hegemony. Unlike Hank's on-screen bookstore tycoon, Dodd promises that Barnes & Noble's expansion will not put it in conflict with its independent rivals, that the pie of book readers and book buyers can grow. For the most part, he argues that the chain is repairing a past overcorrection that left many areas with no place to buy books at all. We're actually repopulating a devastated landscape that needs bookstores, Daunt told me. Some independent bookstores say it is still too close for comfort. All told, the good vibes of Barnes & Noble's comeback show just how much American culture has changed since the day when the company was a big bad wolf blowing down the walls of indie bookstores. Anti-chain animus was once a popular strain of urban politics. Neither shoppers nor city leaders can afford to be so picky these days. After revising design guidelines to encourage the development of more storefronts, some cities have found they cannot find enough businesses to fill them. Barnes & Noble's purchase of a distressed local shops in Denver and San Francisco has been bittersweet for book lovers in those cities, who may resent the chain but relish the preservation of their local institutions. Like all big chains, when you shop there, more of your money leaves the community than when you shop at something locally owned. Josh Cook, a bookseller and co-owner of Porter Square Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts, told me. But he added, anything that takes market share from Amazon is positive. That broader post-Amazon retail crisis reveals another aspect of the Barnes & Noble story that is harder to emulate. Like local bookstores that picked up buyers when chain stores closed, the chain is now benefiting from its perseverance as other middle-class shopping destinations vanish. Analysts have dubbed this phenomenon the K-shaped economy, divided between an upper branch of high-end shoppers and a lower branch buying basics at chains such as Family Dollar and Walmart. Daunt believes that Barnes & Noble makes room for a type of book buyer who might not feel at ease in independent bookstores, in which customers, he said, are met with a sort of scrutiny and also a sense of intellectual expectation. Recent trips to Barnes & Noble in three different parts of the country revealed a bookstore experience that, to an indie shop regular, was as maximalist as going from a city corner store to a suburban supermarket with its 45 types of peanut butter. Shelves full of books of logic puzzles, a rack of magazines about baseball and model airplanes, volume after volume of mass market fantasy, sci-fi, and romance in quantities that would swallow a small bookstore, not to mention a lot of toys and games. With their spacious aisles and laid-back atmosphere, Barnes & Noble stores have become a popular stage set for TikToks, matching indie bookstores' quirky appeal on Instagram. Unaccompanied teens have lately been viewed as a problem for corporate retail, but Daunt says they are his company's most important customers. One of the great joys of chain bookstores is that they have a certain anonymous and wholly democratic, with a small d, welcome to them, he said. Daunt isn't moving Barnes & Noble's into just a devastated bookstore landscape, but one suddenly lacking in stores that feel like they are for everyone. The family-friendly, middle-brow chains of a previous century are a dying breed. Barnes & Noble endures as a place where just about anyone can be comfortably set loose for an hour or two. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.